I asked Keith to lead that song. I love to tell the story. And he did. And I appreciate that. But he went further and surrounded that song by several others that focus on Jesus Christ and that wonderful story. Of all the various topics that I may preach on, it is indeed a pleasure to me to be able to preach on the story of Jesus. I love to tell the story. But one good thing about preaching that kind of message to this audience is another line in that song where it says, "Those who know it best are hungering and thirsting to hear it like the rest." And I trust that's true with you this morning. We're going to be focusing our lesson on Jesus Christ. And to set the stage for our study, I'm going to do something that I do not normally do at the beginning of a lesson. I normally open to a text, but I'm going to read a poetic piece. I've altered it somewhat and adapted it for my purposes. It was written, as far as I can tell, way back in the 20s of the last century, and then edited and used in song. But hopefully it will set the stage for our study this morning. Here was a man who was born in a small village, the son of a young, common, unmarried woman. He grew up in another small, disreputable village. Until he reached the age of 30, he worked as a carpenter. Then for 3 years, he was a traveling minister. But he never traveled more than 200 miles from where he was born, and where he did go, he usually walked. He never held political office. He never wrote a book. He never bought a home. He never married or had children. He never went to college. Yet, here was a man. He never did one of the things that you usually associate with greatness. He had no credentials but himself. He had no worldly aspirations except for the divine purpose that brought him into this world. While he was still a young man, the tide of popular opinion turned against him. One of his friends betrayed him and turned him over to his enemies. In his darkest hour, his closest friends deserted him. One of them denied him. Then he went through the mockery of a trial and was nailed to a Roman cross between two thieves. When he was dead, he was taken down from the cross and laid in a borrowed grave provided by a compassionate friend. More than 19 centuries have come and gone, and today he's the centerpiece of the human race, leader in the column of human destiny. And I think I'm well within the mark when I say that. All of the armies that have ever marched, all of the navies that have ever sailed, all of the legislative bodies that have ever sat, all of the kings that have ever reigned, all of them put together have not affected the life of man on this earth so powerfully as that one solitary life. Indeed, here was a man. This was a real man, not a mythological man. If you were here in the Bible class, in fact, Todd was dealing with that very issue. We have 27. Now, you can establish the historicity of Jesus with four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But actually, there are 27 letters written by at least 8 different authors. Letters written to individuals, letters written to churches, letters that were in circulation in the first century. All of them attesting to and founded upon the fact that there was a real man that walked this earth, and his name was Jesus. But besides the 27 letters, we have what's called the Church Fathers. The Church Fathers are just ancient writers, religious men, who in their writings also talked about this man named Jesus. I have a list of some of them here. Polycarp lived from about 70 to 156 A.D. Ignatius from about 70 to 110. Justin, 133 A.D. Irenaeus, 170 A.D. Besides the 27 letters, you have these other authors, writers, who testify that there was a man named Jesus. But then you have men who were not necessarily religious and not necessarily favorable to the gospel of Jesus Christ. For example, we have the Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus, born 52 to 54 A.D. That gives inadvertent testimony to the existence of a man named Jesus. Lucian, a satirist, 2nd century. Flavius Josephus, a Jewish historian. And you know that the Jews were the most diligent persecutors of Christ and Christianity up until 70 A.D. And yet he testified, in his writings, testifies to the existence of a man named Jesus, born 37 A.D. Suetonius, the Roman historian, in 120 A.D. In the class that Todd is teaching, he has taken a quote from an avid opponent of Christianity, Bart Ehrman, who, while he does not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, has testified to the fact that anybody who treats the evidence fairly must admit the historicity of Jesus. I've got another quote here. It's from a fellow named F.F. Bruce, Rylands Professor of Biblical Criticism and Exegesis at the University of Manchester. Here's what he said. Some writers may toy with the fancy of a Christ myth, but they do not do so on the ground of historical evidence. The historicity of Christ is as axiomatic for an unbiased historian as the historicity of Julius Caesar. It is not historians who propagate the Christ myth theories. You young people that are in this audience now who are not in Todd's class, in time to come when you get into high school or college, you face these very issues. I hope that you'll take the time to investigate the real evidence. And if you have availability to the recordings that Todd is doing, they'll strengthen your faith. Jesus was a real man. Here was a man who did not come from this earth. John chapter 6. Look at John chapter 6. This is a rather stunning claim. Imagine if you met a man today who said, "I'm not from here." That's what Jesus claimed. In John chapter 6 and verse 38, very plainly, to a large audience, he said, "I have come down from heaven." In verse 41, the Jews were grumbling about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down out of heaven." They understood that's what he was claiming. That's what gave them trouble. They said, verse 42, "Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know?" By the way, there's a testimony to the historicity of Jesus by his enemies. How does he say, "I have come down out of heaven"? In verse 51, that did not deter Jesus from making this claim, though it bothered those people and they could not explain it. He said, "I am the living bread that came down out of heaven." In Matthew chapter 1 and in verse 18, Matthew undertakes to write about Jesus, and he undertakes to write about Jesus to that group of people who were his strongest opponents, the Jews. And he begins this story about Jesus with a statement that he didn't come from here. Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, and then there's this important statement, before they came together, before they engaged in the normal sexual act that produces babies, while she was still a virgin. That's the remarkable thing about it. Before they came together, she was found to be with child. But how can it be? Never in the history of man had it happened. And the last phrase of the verse tells you, by the Holy Spirit. Jesus existed before that body was found in the womb of Mary. He came from heaven and entered into a human body. It's called today the incarnation. Carnal is the idea of flesh. He entered into human flesh. The knowledge that he displayed, even as a young boy of 12 years old, Luke chapter 2. If you look at Luke chapter 2 and verse 42, this is an incident when he was but 12. And if you'll go down to verse 46, you see that after 3 days, his parents found him in the temple, sitting at the midst of the teachers. Not just listening. He was listening to them. How many 12-year-old boys would even be interested in what teachers in the temple were teaching in the first place? But then it says, and asking them questions. And evidently, they weren't dumb questions. In fact, the text says, all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers at 12 years old. As you read the text further, you see in verse 49, he understands already at the age of 12 that he has a higher mission, a mission typified by the temple, but not culminated in it. I must be about my Father's house or business. In John chapter 7, let me go back before we get to this next chart. Look at John chapter 7 and verse 15. John chapter 7 and verse 15, the Jews were astonished, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? He didn't come from here. He didn't go to school here. Where did he get it all? He had it all before he came. He was from heaven. Here was a man who performed unprecedented, unexplainable, supernatural works. If Jesus made the claims he did, how many supernatural works would he have to perform to convince you that there was substance to his story? What if he could do one undeniable work? What if he could take a person who was blind from birth and everybody knew it and make the man see? Would that be sufficient? What if that one man was questioned by his religious teachers and he answered every question? What if his parents said, yes, that's our son. He was blind and now he sees. We can't tell you how, but he's our son. What if all the neighbors knew that was the man? Would that be enough? That's just one. What if you were following him along and a funeral procession came through and there was a boy that was being carried on a casket? The widow's son. And he raised him from the dead. Would that one be enough? The fact is, his ministry lasted a little over 3 years. There are over 35, at least 35, separate recorded miracles. That is, they say, here's what he did. That's approximately one a month. Would that be enough to convince you that here was a man like no other man that had ever lived or ever would live? But that's not all. These are just a small sampling of the unexplainable supernatural works that he did. When John recorded the pinnacle of his signs, the resurrection from the dead, he then said in John 20 and 30, "Therefore many, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book." Right at the end of this letter, chapter 21 and verse 25, he said, "There are also many other things which Jesus did, which, if they were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." What's interesting, as you go back to John chapter 7 and verse 31, the people, the crowd, the populace, many of the crowd believed in him. And they were saying, "When the Christ comes, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he?" Observe that the populace was not saying, "We're at a dedicated adherence of this man as the Christ." That's not it. What they are testifying to is the fact that he's doing some very unusual things that no other men do. Does this testify? Does this seal the fact that here is a man who's different from all other men, in fact, the Messiah that was promised? That's their question. And when you get to chapter 11, a very remarkable testimony to these things, and that is this. John 11, 47, the chief priests and the Pharisees, they hated him. They wanted to kill him, and they were scheming how they could do it. And so they convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs." You would think that would convince people, wouldn't you? People say today, "If I could just see a miracle." No, that will not necessarily convince people. If they're so full of pride and prejudice, they can block out the logical conclusion of that. But the fact is, here was a man who performed unprecedented, unexplainable, undeniable, supernatural works. What's interesting about these things that he did is that he made it a test of the truth of his claims. You would think a man like this, making these outstanding claims, might expect people just believe him, but he didn't. In John chapter 5 and verse 36, he said, "The testimony which I have is greater than the testimony of John." That was great testimony. That was the testimony of John the Baptist. But he said, "The works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works I do testify about me." And what do they testify about me? Look at the last part of the verse. "That the Father has sent me. That I came from heaven. That I'm here on a divine mission. That what I'm teaching is the will of Almighty God." He made that challenge. In John chapter 10, you see it again. In John chapter 10 and verse 37. "If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me." That's fair enough, isn't it? If you can show that these supposed works I'm doing are fraudulent, if you can show that I'm doing them by the power of the devil, which is logically inconsistent, and he dealt with that, don't believe me. But he said, "If I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works." You don't have to put your faith simply in my claims. I'm supporting my claims by unprecedented, unexplainable, supernatural signs and miracles. And so, believe the work so that you may know and understand what? The Father is in me and I in the Father. There's a relationship of unity, perfect unity between me and the Father. And so the God that you claim to worship perfectly supports the ministry that I'm engaged in and the gospel that I'm preaching. Even his own disciples, John chapter 14. He's getting ready to give, he's discussing with them this very difficult mission that they would have. That is to go and tell this story. You'd think a story like this, a story with such support and objective evidences, a story that has such love behind it, a story with such promises in it, everybody would welcome that story. But in fact, he says, when you tell this story, they're going to hate you. And they're going to kick you out of the synagogue. And they're going to want to kill you. And I'm telling you now, he said, you're going to have tribulation. That's what he told them. What would enable those men to keep telling the story? He didn't offer them money. He didn't offer them power. He didn't offer them fame. In John chapter 14, verse 11, believe me that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me. Or else believe because of the works themselves. If they had a faith that could not be overturned, could not be assailed, they'd die for that story. And they did. Here was a man that performed the kind of miracles that his friends said he performed them. In Acts chapter 2, Peter, one of the close associates of Jesus, on the day of Pentecost, before this multitude said, Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God. This is verse 22. Attested to you. What is that? He provided the way to test his claims. Attested to you by God with what? Miracles and wonders and signs. But there's more. Which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. Folks, you know. If these people had not seen those things, that would have been the end of this event. They knew. And Peter said he worked these signs that attested who he was. In Matthew chapter 12 and verse 24. We've already looked at John 11:47, where the chief priests and elders admitted that he was working these signs. In Matthew 12:24, the Pharisees said, this man cast out demons. They said he cast out demons. That means he had power over the spiritual world. Well, why didn't they believe in him? Look at the next part of that sentence. They said he did it by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. Did it by the devil. And Jesus pointed out the logical inconsistency of that. If that's the case, here I am destroying the rule of the devil and doing it by the power of the devil. That doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't. You know, there was no one that ever claimed that the miracles of Jesus were fraudulent until about 100 years later. Isn't that interesting? People deny the miracles of Jesus today, but unless I've missed it somewhere, no one claimed he did not work, unprecedented, unexplainable, supernatural works, until about 100 years had passed. The people that lived when he lived, and in the 60 or 70 years thereafter, did not deny that he worked the miracles. Well, why are they denied? One of the reasons is, people say, well, miracles are impossible. Well, they are if there is no God. But if there is a God who in the beginning created heaven and earth, well, miracles are certainly possible. So that presupposes that there is no God. Somebody says, well, miracles are contrary to human experience. That begs the question. Because I have these four books, plus others of the 27 letters, where people said, we saw the miracles. There were witnesses. Can you imagine a being denying that there's winter? A butterfly lives, what, 3 months? Suppose it's born in the spring and dies in the summer. He could say, there's no such thing as cold weather and snow because I've never seen it. He said, that's foolish. Because I live in the 21st century, and because people from the second century on have not witnessed these things, doesn't mean they didn't happen. In fact, if the very purpose of these miracles was to establish one event in history, that is, God came to the earth, they had probable cause and sufficient power behind them, it's very reasonable to believe in miracles. Another reason they're denied, Todd dealt with this in his class, is because they're counterfeit miracles. Do you believe these faith healers that go around supposedly working miracles? No, I don't. I think they're frauds. Well, there, that shows you that that's what the New Testament was. No, it doesn't. Any more so than there are counterfeit 20s proves that there's no real $20 bills. The fact that there are counterfeit miracles says that there's some value in them, is what it says. People don't counterfeit pennies. Yes, they're counterfeit miracles. But that in no way undermines the fact that we have abundant evidence for the fact that Jesus worked unexplainable, supernatural signs and wonders to prove that he came from heaven. In John chapter 20, we've read verse 30. I want to read it again with the next verse. Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that. So why are we talking about them this morning? Here's the reason right here. So that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that believing, you may have life in his name. This is not an academic study. It's not something you read about in school and you know the right answer so you can get a good grade. Whether or not this man was who he claimed to be affects every person in this audience. Jesus said, except you believe that I'm he, you will die in your sins. So you can just say, I don't know. I'm not interested in studying. Or you have to realize knowing it, knowing whether it's true, can affect not only your relationship with God today, but your eternal destiny. This Jesus, this man, made claims and challenges that no other man had the right to claim. That is, he said this: if you want to be his disciple, you've got to hate your mother and your father and your brother and your sister and your wife and even your own life. Look, those of us who say, I believe in Jesus, is that faith strong enough to make serving Jesus the preeminent thing in our lives? Or is that our job? Or our family? Our peace? Our happiness? Or whatever? This is a man that says, I'm worthy of everything you are and everything you have. Okay. That's the end of the lesson. But, there's a great day coming. And if this man is who he claims to be, you'll find out if it's true. Because he's going to be on the other side of the judgment bar. And people will be separated into two classes. And the determining factor will be whether they believed that here was a man who came from heaven, died for the sins of mankind, arose the third day, the Son of God, that claims that he has the right to your allegiance and mine. And so you think about that as together we stand and sing.